Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party, the podcast that is for your ears only and guaranteed to leave you shaken, not stirred. The name is King, Dallas King, 007, licensed to pod. But every spy needs a guy in the chair, so with me today is the Melissa McCarthy to my Jason Statham, the Q who makes sure all the tech stuff is A-OK while sipping his tea from his Scrabble mug. It's co-host Lee Hutchison. How are you?
I actually own that Scrabble mug.
I know, I saw it in your flat, which is why I managed to shoehorn it into the reference.
Very well played.
Excellent. So how are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. It's been a kind of interesting week in terms of film news. You know, when we kind of put up our pod phones last week, we discovered this big news about James Bond, and then just before we kind of have started today, someone like Matt Smith has been added to Star Wars. So yeah, it seems like it's, and kind of everything else that's gone on in between, it sounds like it's been a kind of big week for films, really.
Indeed. I don't know if you listen to the Empire podcast, but I think they always seem to record it on a Thursday, and they always moan that basically as soon as they record a podcast, some interesting news will break that they really should have covered, and by the time they get to cover it, it's late. But yeah, last week was pretty much all Bond news, but we're going to cover that in a segment later on. But first of all, we're going to talk about our reviews of the week, and we both saw Black Klansman by Spike Lee, and we were both at the same screening in Aberdeen for that one. So Black Klansman is the new film by Spike Lee, and it's about, based on the true story, one of those incredible true stories that seems too good to be true, but it did happen. As again, it says it's based, I think it was, the film comes out and says, based on some full real shit, but perhaps slightly tenuously based. But it's about the story of a black police officer in Colorado Springs in the early 70s who manages to infiltrate the KKK over the phone, and then needs to set up a sting operation with a fellow officer. And yeah, it's just one of those films which, again, like you say, it's so hard to believe that this actually happened, but I think it's one of the most important films you'll probably see this year. So what were your thoughts on it?
I found it quite an exciting watch in terms of, like, you watch this movie and it's almost, you almost get the impression of sort of a young filmmaker, or either kind of a veteran filmmaker that's making their potentially first or last ever movie, and they've got so many ambitious ideas that they try and cram it all into this kind of movie. And I don't mean that as an insult. I think that's like one of the most exciting elements of this film, is it brings together so many parts. It's comedy, it's drama, it's a social commentary on the world we live in. It becomes a somewhat documentary, you know, for a few moments here and there. It shines a light on American history. It's more than just this kind of concept of, hey, it's a black man that manages to infiltrate the KKK and how it all unfolds. It says a lot about America at the time, America now, how it gets there, how it's perhaps not evolved the way it perhaps should have done. It was just so exciting to see Spike Lee throw everything on the screen with this, like there was no tomorrow. I just find that so fascinating to watch, as a fan of film, I felt so excited and fascinated by it. I think there's so much with this movie to dissect, and I think when it kind of become, you know, once a few years pass, it's going to be really interesting to see how history views this film in the context of sort of a Trump presidency and what we're seeing all around it.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't really avoid the Trump-sized elephant in the room when watching this film, because there's so many sort of uses of language and phrases that are potentially might have been used verbatim at the time, but definitely Spike Lee had an eye on this when preparing the script, that the stuff about, you know, America first and things like that. And it's just like they elicited a lot of sort of awkward, nervous laughter in the screen. I think it was fair to be say that people were laughing at how relevant it is, and how, I mean, there's one scene where Ron Stallworth is chastised for being naive, because he says that, oh, come on, America would never elect someone like David Duke into office in America. And of course, we all know what's happened in the 40 years since. So it's one of those films that is of a time, you know, the period detail is spot on. It is a 70s film, but it is so shockingly relevant to this thing that it's one of those films that I highly recommend that anyone go and see. I mean, what I didn't actually realise until sort of reading up about the film afterwards is that the lead actor, John David Washington, is actually Denzel Washington's son. I had no idea that was. And, you know, he's fantastic in this film.
No, nor did I.
No, yeah, it's just a fantastic performance by him. And it's a sort of great sort of a team effort between him and Adam Driver as the two Ron Stallworth, because he's initially sort of chastised by the department because he's made this phone call to the KKK, but he used his real name, and therefore he has to, obviously he can't meet them for obvious reasons, so he needs to get a white officer to play the part of Ron Stallworth to go along to infiltrate these meetings and stuff like that. And that falls to Adam Driver, who just once again is, you know, one of the best actors working today, I think. And I think he's fantastic in any single film that he's in, and he's just one of those actors that anytime I see him in the cast, it's like I've got to see what he's doing, because I just think he's absolutely fantastic. So what did you think of the two Ron Stallworths of the film?
Yeah, John David Washington was an actor I was somewhat unfamiliar with, though looking back on his kind of back catalogue, it feels like I want to kind of dive into that now. I think with Adam Driver, he's someone that I will see in any film that he stars in, you know, for a lot of people. It's like, oh, it's Kylo Ren. Like, it's almost this weird thing Adam Driver has where people associate him with, obviously, the Star Wars movies, but, like, kind of, he does a lot of these sort of other movies that probably don't really kind of ever get the attention of kind of mainstream audiences or kind of break into that kind of cycle. You know, you think of things like While We're Young, Francis Ha, and, you know, they're seen by a sort of certain crowd, but the sort of people that probably broadly will go see Star Wars will be unfamiliar with kind of his work. So kind of to see a movie like this, which has broken out, you know, it's hopefully people will see Adam Driver in that kind of different way. He will always be a darling of indie cinema and independent and original films, and I hope people kind of can see him in that way as well, because I have no doubts about him that he will never be typecast, you know, despite the fact he's playing this Sith madman and, you know, kind of Star Wars movies. So I'm excited to see that, you know, hopefully audiences will see him as perhaps more than just that kind of character.
Absolutely, because I mean, this is a man who, as I'm just going to go through the directors that he's worked with in the last few years, Terry Gilliam, Spike Lee, Steven Soderbergh, Martin Scorsese, Jim Jarmusch, who else have we got here? Yeah, we've got What If Tracks, you know, Coen Brothers, Steven Spielberg and Lincoln. You know, he's nearly ticked off Clint Eastwood and J. Edgar as well. Look at that. I mean, he's basically worked with all the top names already and basically managed to do it going under the radar before blowing up in Star Wars. So, I mean, I don't think there's no end to the guy's talent, and, you know, I think he's got a great career ahead of him, and I'm very excited for anything he does and what, you know, will potentially be doing in the future. But, I mean, there's a lot of unsung heroes in this film as well, and, you know, an actor who probably doesn't get a lot of credit these days, basically, also potentially for his involvement in a franchise, is Topher Grace. And I thought he was excellent in the film as David Duke, sort of balancing the right line between playing it up, hamming it up slightly, but still, you know, delivering a quality performance as well.
Yeah, he seems to play, he is almost probably like the real kind of David Duke, that David Duke was like this out and out fascist, really, but he kind of did it in a suit and with a bit of a smile and a bit of a, hey, how are you, kind of, you know, that he was sort of trying to bridge that gap from white supremacist to a kind of politician. And I remember when I'd watched the trailers for this movie, I never once picked up that it was Topher Grace, but I thought he was absolutely brilliant in this film, and I can see this being something that could kind of kickstart a bit of a career that's been a bit stalled for a little while. I thought he was brilliant in this. You know, the kind of David Duke kind of has been a bit synonymous with, you know, as you kind of see towards the end when they show his antics in Charlottesville, you know, where you have to think about, like, Donald Trump was going, I don't know who this guy is, you know, David Duke, you'll have to show me who this guy is before I can really say that he's a terrible human being. So it was really fascinating to sort of get the, you know, I'm familiar with David Duke in sort of the modern era, but not so much those kind of early days as he was looking to potentially become a politician. I know he's ran and failed many times to sort of become a senator or a congressperson for Louisiana, and I've seen one or two of his debates, which are a bit car crash worthy, but I thought he was, you know, really impressive in this. You know, everyone is great in this. You know, you want more from these people. And, you know, even Michael Buscemi, I was like watching at the beginning going, who's this guy that looks like Steve Buscemi? And it's like, I never even knew he had a brother that was like pretty much his spitting image.
Is that his brother? Because I think I did the same. I thought it's like, it kind of looks like Steve Buscemi, but it's not Steve Buscemi. So I meant to check out who it was afterwards. I did not realize that he had a brother. Well, there you go. But I mean, all the performances across the board are fantastic. But for me, this is Spike Lee's film. It's probably, I think we both agree that it was his best film since The 25th Hour.
Yes.
His last feature film was the remake of Old Boy, the rather ill-advised remake of Old Boy. I mean, I think over the last sort of decade, he's more focused on sort of documentaries and stuff like this. But I just thought it was an assured, accomplished and topical, and, you know, it's a piece of work that needed to be said, especially in the sort of time that we live in. And the greatest thing that he does in this film is he manages to walk that tightrope between sort of humor and horror. And it's one where, you know, you're laughing 1 minute, but then you're just shocked at the next minute. And, you know, he does, I mean, there's three particular members of the Ku Klux Klan who come across as basically as inept as the nihilists. It makes the nihilists from The Big Lebowski look like, you know, criminal masterminds here. It's got, I can't remember the actor's name, but it's the guy who plays the bodyguard in I, Tonya, and they're just completely incompetent. But it's never at the expense of how dangerous they are and almost how normal the sort of evil and malice within them is. It's, you know, you've got these people talking about burning crosses and lynching and stuff like this while, you know, their cookie cutter American wife is sort of serving cookies to the Ku Klux Klan and stuff like this. It's how shockingly normal and sort of widespread this was, and probably still is, and that's the most terrifying thing about it. But it's handled incredibly well by Spike Lee, that, you know, he can take the mickey out of the Ku Klux Klan, but he never forgets, you know, the power and the sort of hatred that they had, I thought.
Yeah, like, and it's one of these films you can't dismiss as pure fiction as well. Like, through that whole film, you're like, it is a bit uncomfortable how close it is to reality, how little kind of distance America has travelled in what it's shining a light on. And I mean, it was almost beyond parody that when we came out of the cinema, you know, I switched my phone back on again. My first notification was like a CNN thing where it was like, Donald Trump shares a discredited Ku Klux Klan alt-right conspiracy theory. And it's like, that's the reality of the world. You can't just watch this film and go, ah, well, you know, that's a crazy old world, you know, let's go back into our more civilized time. And then, like, it hits you just straight away. I genuinely couldn't believe that was what was on my phone waiting for me after a film like that.
Yeah, I know, it's one of these films, especially as it moves from its fiction to the sort of final sort of scenes, which takes sort of real life news footage and phone camera footage from the, I think it was the Charlottesville sort of protest last year, and just basically shows that, you know, it's 40 years since this story was told, and, you know, there's still a hell of a lot of work to do. I mean, there's that incredibly powerful scene in the middle of the film where there's a Black Student Association having a meeting where there's a lawyer talking about this case about how a guy was tried guilty and sort of marched out into the streets and sort of beaten and then set on fire and stuff like this. And it's cross-cutting with the scene of an initiation ceremony for the Ku Klux Klan, with them then having a party and watching Birth of a Nation. And it's just utterly terrifying about how, you know, those two things can basically be put side by side, and how, you know, yeah, not enough has changed in that time. And yeah, there's still have a lot of work to do, but hopefully it's the kind of film that people really should go out and see. And hopefully it's the kind of film that, you know, if it makes a small difference, then that's what film is there for. It's, you know, it's there to, you know, obviously it's entertaining us, but it also can educate us and, you know, even to sort of change opinions and, you know, make changes and stuff like that. So
hear, hear.
Absolutely. So that was Black Klansman, and I think we can both agree that it's a highly recommended film. But what else have you been watching at the cinema this week?
Yeah, I made it sort of a Washington double bill. I went to see Equalizer 2 after seeing Black Klansman, and it was, I enjoyed the first one in particular, the kind of the B&Q style murder showdown. So I kind of had somewhat good hopes for this movie. I found the first half of it, it's probably its best strength, and what I've enjoyed about the Equalizer movies, you know, the Denzel Washington version anyway, has been seeing this character, Robert McCall, just like shooting the breeze, not in a rush, talking to these people in taxis, diners, cafes, you know, giving a bit of world advice, and then things sort of explode and he gets involved in that. And like, I could have watched a whole movie of this sort of hitman for hire, ex-mercenary, just talking with people and hearing their life story, giving a bit of advice. But I found the action scenes in this movie somewhat quite boring, to be honest. You know, the whole big final set piece is like an action scene where it takes place on an island being battered by a hurricane, and there's some snipers and so on. And it's nothing that exciting at all. It's nothing that we've not seen before. And it kind of just was a bit uninspiring. The villains in this movie are completely forgettable. The whole plot is quite uninspired, but you know, in terms of a movie about seeing a sort of philosophical Denzel Washington, was more than exciting enough. And then, you know, two other movies that I caught that were particularly exciting at the cinema, I'm sure we'll talk about this a bit more in a kind of maybe a few weeks time when you potentially get the chance to see it, but I got to see an early preview of The Miseducation of Cameron Post, the Chloe Grace Moretz, Sasha Lane movie about a young teenage girl that's sent away to a gay conversion therapy Jesus Christian center by her conservative guardians, and it's getting a lot of hype, especially after Sundance, and I think it's more than well deserved. I'm sure we'll go into that one a bit later. And I saw The Children Act, which was released by Entertainment One here in the UK, but A24 in America, so I was quite curious to see them, because I always think, well, if A24 have invested in a movie, it must have something to worth my time. But of all the two summer movies to come out about Jehovah's Witnesses and blood transfusion, this is the worst one of the summer. Apostasy, which I spoke about a few weeks ago, which I absolutely loved and think is one of the best films of the year. This was the polar opposite, adapted by Ian McEwan from his original book. It tells a story of a judge, as her marriage is falling apart, who decides to get involved in a case about a teenage boy who is a Jehovah's Witness but is refusing a blood transfusion, and he's too young to make that choice himself legally. And it was really kind of soap opera stuff. It was really uninspired. A marriage in crisis, and Fionn and Whitehead from Dunkirk, who played Tommy in the movie, he is one of the most irritating characters of the year in a film, and I genuinely wanted him to die of the disease that was crippling his body. It was a really difficult and boring watch. It was very uninspiring. So again, if anyone wants to see a movie about Jehovah's Witnesses, go see Apostasy and skip A Children's Act. It's really, you know, I think it was on this festival circuit last year, so it's taken a long time to come out now, so it maybe answers a few questions about why it's taken so long. It's not that great. What about yourself? What have you seen?
Well, I saw The Spy Who Dumped Me as part of, we were talking last week about the 52 films by women challenge, so this was directed by Suzanne Fogel, so I went to see this one. So it stars Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon as two best friends. Mila Kunis has been dumped by Justin Theroux, who turns out to be working in the CIA, and she gets involved in a plot where he's left a certain item of value at the flat, and she has to try and get it to a buyer in Europe before she is murdered by people looking to get this back off her. And it's okay. It's just okay. It's one of these films which is, it's rated a 15, so there's a lot of swearing, there's a lot of violence in it, which kind of doesn't sit with the rest of the film, which is, you know, about a woman trying to sort of learn that she's actually okay on her own and doesn't need a man to define her. And, you know, she's helped by her best friend, and it was actually really pleasing to see a sort of a female friendship portrayed on screen where it's not about trying to get back with a man or whatever. It's about these two friends trying to help each other and, you know, overcome this sort of situation. Kate McKinnon is, once again, hilarious as always. Mila Kunis is also good, but it's got sort of great support from the likes of Gillian Anderson as well. And there's a young woman in it called, I think it's Ivana Sacco, who was in Pacific Rim as well. And every time I see her on screen, I think Elizabeth Olsen has turned up in the film. She's one of the, it's a spitting image of her. But then I realise it's not Elizabeth Olsen. It's this girl instead. But, you know, it's got a lot of strong female characters, but it's just, it's okay. I think the problem is there's too many similarities between this film and Spy, which came out a few years ago, starring Melissa McCarthy. Mm-hmm. There's even some sort of plot twists and things that happen that you go, that is actually pretty much exactly what happened beat for beat in the other film. So it's, you know, if it's all about, rather than that film, it's, you know, you're just watching the same film, but it's got two female leads rather than one, essentially. Well, I mean, Spy technically did have, you know, her teaming up with Miranda Hart, but I think the less said about that, probably the better. So that was that one. And the other film I watched was the new Netflix original film called To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is another one that which is written by a woman, based on her own novels and directed by a woman, so that's fine. And that's another two I've managed to tick off this weekend. And it stars Lana Condor, who played Jubilee in whatever the latest X-Men film
X-Men
was.
X-Men Apocalypse.
That's the one, yeah. I'm almost as bad as Jennifer Lawrence at forgetting the names of these films. And so she stars as a young woman who is basically had been in love with her sister's boyfriend. And what she does is, if she likes someone but is too scared to tell them, she basically writes them a letter. But what she does is she writes them a letter and puts it in an envelope with the name and address on it and a stamp. And then, so she's written five letters to the five crushes that she's had. And then her sister, you know, accidentally, they get mailed out, of course. And then, you know, the boys find out and then her social life is utterly ruined. What's she going to do? She's so embarrassed. But then it sort of goes into this sort of she's all that sort of subplot where there's a sort of fake relationship in order to try and sort of get people off her back and stuff like this. But of course the people who are pretending to be in a relationship actually do end up falling in love, but then you know they're going to break up, but then they're going to get back together again. But I just thought it was like a really sweet film, really well done. I thought the characters were great, and yeah, it was just, you know, it's another one of those that Netflix are slowly but surely picking up a lot of good properties. I mean, it was a Set It Up earlier in the year as well, a few months ago, was another great rom-com. So it's, yeah, it's one of those films which, you know, won't be in my top 10 at the end of the year, but it was just a really nice film to watch on a weekend, I thought. Now, you saw this one as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I've kind of continued with my 52 women, so I'm now into sort of the 30 movies mark for the year. So I did see To All the Boys I've Loved Before, and yeah, I enjoyed it fine enough. I think I like what the movie stands for more than perhaps the film itself. Like, it's not a genre that's probably particularly aimed at this 31-year-old kind of cynic. But I enjoyed the performances fine enough, and I think she, you know, the main actress will become, you know, you see the star quality that she's got. I found the male characters, you know, all quite annoying, and they all looked so alike that it was hard to tell them apart at points. I was like, you know, it seemed like such a limited gene pool that they'd cast from for these male roles. So, you know, it wasn't something I particularly rated too much, but I really hope that, you know, it's been exciting to see the conversation the film has generated in the past week or so, you know, the people that are seeing their representation in the screen in this kind of role as well. So that can only be a good thing. You know, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, that was also directed by a woman as well, Desiree Akhavan. So I'd recommend that. And I also caught Nights and Weekends, Greta Gerwig's first ever movie that she directed, well, co-directed in this case. I watched Morven Keller by Lynn Ramsey. Maggie's Plan, I revisited that on the train journey up to Aberdeen. I revisited Mustang, one of my kind of favourite movies of a few years ago. And I watched a documentary that was co-directed by a woman called Mercury 13, which was really interesting, and I recommend for people that are interested in science, and a good original documentary. It follows the original kind of space pilots that could have been women, as they were put through sort of their paces by NASA to become space pilots, and sort of their legacy. It's a really interesting Netflix original documentary, and it's definitely well worth checking out. So yeah, I would recommend, you know, seeking those movies out.
Absolutely. Now, those films which are co-directed, are you giving yourself one mark for those, or are they a half point?
They will go onto the list because they are obviously directed by kind of a woman as well, but ultimately I would still be looking to go above that 52 mark. I think at the end of the day it's still a female directing, whether that's a co-directing or not with a male. I think it's still classed as a female director in my eyes. So I know some people are, no, it has to be strictly female directors, but I think, you know, you should always be looking to add movies that, whether it was co-directed or not by, you know, a male with them or not, I still think it counts in my eyes. And it, you know, it I wouldn't want to deny a movie solely based on that, but to make it up, I will definitely make sure to consider sort of an extra couple movies. But other opinions are more than welcome on that 52 issue.
I'm sure you'll be pouring through the London Film Festival catalogue when it gets released at the end of the week to find a few more to add to that list, and I'm sure we'll be talking about a few of them next week, because you're going to be down for the festival.
Absolutely.
Aren't you?
Yeah, it's out on Thursday, the catalogue, so I'm very, very excited for it.
Absolutely. So, but the main reason we're here today to talk about in that is the fallout from the big Bond news next week, and it was safe to say that it was quite shocking to find out the old creative differences statement being thrown out again, as Barbara Broccoli went off the boil, so to speak. That's a good pun for it. And because Danny Boyle left the project in a tweet that was sent out from the official James Bond account that had the names of the producers and Daniel Craig, who I think is actually now a full producer on the Bond films, if I'm correct. So it certainly
was a producer for Spectre, wasn't he?
Yeah, so he's got a lot of clout, and I guess with him being the main star, that, you know, it says a lot that he was mentioned in that as well, so it must have had his support for the changing of the guard. But I can't help but think that this news coming, you know, 2 weeks after Mission Impossible Fallout has blown us all away, it seems slightly too coincidental, that the timing around that. So what did you make of the news when it first dropped?
Yeah, well, I'd been for a run at the time. I was going to a Wednesday evening race, so I just sort of got to the start of the race point, and, you know, I was just relaxing. You know, I took my phone out to pause my music, and I noticed Matt Rushen from Aggressive Negotiations had sent something in the Nerd Party group chat, and all I just saw was Matt Rushen has shared 007 Twitter update, and I was like, here we go, we're going to get some casting news, there's maybe going to be, you know, something's going to be announced here. And I remember just looking at it and going, oh, that isn't what I expected at all. And it threw me off. It to see all three of their names kind of on that page, on that tweet, was genuinely really surprising and really disappointing as well. And I think kind of the news that's sort of come out in the few days afterwards, that, you know, you're always like, right, here we go, we're going to find out what the big blow was all about and everything. And it feels like it's been a kind of nothing event that seems to have really triggered it. There hasn't been some sort of huge expose saying, oh, it was this huge conflict behind the scenes. It seems to have just come down to a disagreement about the casting of a villain, really. I'm surprised. I'm confused a little bit too.
Yeah, no, I saw that. I think that apparently, I didn't know if it was Danny Boyle was wanting to cast apparently the lead actor from Pavel Pavlovsky's new film Cold War as a Russian villain. Back to the Russians.
Tomazov Kot. It's out on Friday, and I will be seeing it this weekend. So it was at the film festival, but it was a really last minute addition. So I'm desperate to see the movie. So I can almost feel like, you know, if I watch this movie and I'm on, like, I think this guy is going to be great. You know, this movie won, you know, a huge award at Cannes. Danny Boyle is brilliant at casting. I just am really confused. You know, I want to watch this movie and almost go, oh, right, I'm still trying to process why they would fight over this kind of guy.
Yeah, no, but it's like, so yeah, Danny Boyle left, and then a couple of days later, I think it's been confirmed that John Hodge, who had written the script has now left, so, and now they have officially delayed, I'm not sure if they've officially, but they've definitely sort of delayed the release date and stuff like that, because they're not going to get it finished in time, because it looks like they might be sort of looking at a new script and whatever. So I guess now is as good a time as any is to, guess, to sort of talk about, you know, what we were wanting from a Danny Boyle Bond film and what you would like to see happen with the franchise going forward. So what were you most excited to see from a Danny Boyle Bond film?
I was excited to see the look Danny Boyle would bring to a movie like this. That with kind of Danny Boyle, he's got such a diverse range of films. You know, he's the guy that can do a Trainspotting, a Slumdog Millionaire, a science fiction movie like Sunshine. He's a man for all seasons. And he's always been a director that, when it's always been put around, hey, who could be a new Bond director? And, you know, I'm not just sort of thinking in the past few years. I'm thinking, you know, from the original days of the Daniel Craig movies, the Pierce Brosnan's, like, who'd be a good director? Well, Danny Boyle. I mean, he's directed one of the most iconic Daniel Craig James Bond moments in terms of the Olympic scene where he's got the Queen and they're parachuting out of a helicopter. I was excited to see what he was going to bring. That he was one of these directors that I always expected at some point in his life was going to direct a James Bond movie, and it always made perfect sense that he was the chosen one for this movie. And I was curious to see how he would go about it. You know, John Hodge, another Scottish writer as well. I was excited to see what he would write. And with the fact that they had got rid of this Purvis and Wade script, and they were like, you know, I will direct this movie if I'm happy with the script. So John Hodge is going to come in and do a page one rewrite. Like, it was going to be a Danny Boyle movie that he approved of. It wasn't going to be Danny Boyle as a director for hire. It was going to be a Danny Boyle project. It was going to be a Danny Boyle film. And I'm really disappointed that that's now gone. And I know John Hodge has left, but I don't know how much of his script's going to be left, if they're going to do a page one rewrite. You know, it feels like we've potentially lost this great potential script. You know, it might have been terrible, it might have been the most exciting thing ever. It's hard to know now, and it could be one of these like great what ifs, like what was the script for this movie? And unless the North Koreans hacked Sony again and release all these scripts and stuff, we might never know what John Hodge did. I'm hugely disappointed as a lifelong James Bond fan that it's come to this, and I feel disappointed in Daniel Craig that he's been involved in outing Danny Boyle. Like, you know, that's kind of my feeling on the matter. What about yourself?
I know, I think it would have been a very, very different Bond film, absolutely. But I thought that's what they were wanting to do, because, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of Spectre, but, you know, it seemed like Daniel Craig's era as Bond had been wrapped up in a sort of a neat little bow. You know, he was off walking into the distance with Madeleine Swann, Blofeld was, you know, arrested. It seemed like that was his moment to leave, so there must have been something in the project. I know he had a contract and whatever, but I'm sure if they decided, you know, we want to go in a different direction now, we're going to get in a new Bond, that would have been fine with him. There must have been something in the script of the story that intrigued him enough that he wanted to come back and play this. So it seems interesting that something as small as like the choice of a actor for the villain would, you know, cause all this. So, you know, it's going to be another one of those things where, you know, it's one of those alternative realities where, you know, Danny Boyle has directed a Bond film, Guillermo del Toro directed The Hobbit, potentially only one film, not three, Edgar Wright directed Ant-Man and stuff like this. So, you know, just one of those lost opportunities. But, you know, at the moment now we're looking at a situation where I think it's Yann Demange, who did sort of 71, is being talked about. David McKenzie is once again being talked about. There's a silly rumour going around that apparently Edgar Wright was on the shortlist, and I can basically guarantee that will never happen. You know, if he wasn't happy with about the lack of control that Marvel were going to give him over Ant-Man, I can't see him getting much more with producers rushing to get a Bond film out for a certain release date. So I can't see
him. Yeah, that's so stupid, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I know people have like, talked about, I think, Christopher McQuarrie as well, and it's like, he's just come back off of Mission Impossible. He's not going to do this. He's happy in the Mission Impossible franchise, even though he said many times now he will not do another one. You know, I could see him coming back and finishing off his trilogy of those, so I can't see him jumping ship to Bond. So I think, unfortunately, we're probably looking at a sort of situation here where they get a sort of workman-like journeyman to come in. You know, the joke is, you know, of course, Ron Howard's, you know, waiting by the phone for that phone call to come in and finish the job. But I think Martin Campbell's been rumoured as well. It's stuff to come back in and basically get the ship back on track, you know. So I guess we'll just have to see who they go with. And I think the choice of director will sort of tell us a lot about the sort of what sort of type of film it's going to be.
Yeah, like the movie I want to see, kind of, and regardless of now Danny Boyle or, you know, and as ridiculous as they claim Edgar Wright, whoever is that, you know, Daniel Craig is now getting on. I think he's maybe in his early 50s now, 48. Like, I'm not too sure.
I think
sure,
he's around 49, 50, yeah. So the longer they leave it, the older he's going to be before he gets in front of the camera. So.
And he looked tired as an actor and as a person, really, when the kind of Spectre came out. And I didn't expect him to come back, so I was surprised that all that money managed to make him come back, because, you know, he strikes me as that type of person that he would say no to something if he didn't want to do it regardless of the money. And what I want to see from the movie is something more in the sort of the veins of kind of something like a License to Kill, where if they were going to bring it back, that I have no real interest in the character of Madeline whatsoever, and I wanted it all to be sort of a stripped down kind of movie, and, you know, have it all so much the pre-title sequence be Madeline, she's shot, she's killed, she's done with, and, you know, Daniel Craig's Bond kind of goes on this sort of small intimate journey that plays to him as more of an actor than this sort of like big action hero that is very difficult to do. You know, Tom Cruise can do it, you know, not many people can be in the sort of their 50s and make it look effortless, and it was really exciting to maybe see something like that where it plays to him as sort of like this, you know, drama, it's tense, it's, you know, the action scenes are something that's really scaled down, it's intimate, it's bloody, and it kind of plays to him as an actor as opposed to kind of a superhero or an action hero. And that's what I was kind of hoping for, you know, a sort of a low budget kind of movie. And I think with John Hodge, with his work on things like Trainspotting 2 and Filth, and kind of Danny Boyle's strength in that kind of like British drama, I thought that could be very possible. And if they hire a big name sort of director, you know, it will maybe make that something like that less likely. I'm really not too sure. And I said it at the time, even though he put his name to it, will Daniel Craig stay on the longer this goes on? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that would be quite a good way to go. Yeah, sort of. Because it's like we said, so at the end of Spectre, it seems like Bond is walking away from everything. So there must be something happened to him to bring him back into the fold. So if it is like a John Wick style sort of thing where someone kills his girlfriend, wife, or dog or something, and then he has to go on a tale of revenge, I'm sure we'd like to see that. But I mean, Bond has always, and certainly from the Daniel Craig years, it has been very reactionary to what else has been around. So, you know, the people were slagging off the later Pierce Brosnan ones for some of the CG and stuff, the sort of overblown sort of sequences, but then, you know, the Bourne films came in, which were very gritty, real, had that sort of fast cutting. Actually, there's Paul Greengrass now, there's a name that hasn't been mentioned yet for
that
Bond.
Would be good.
That would be interesting. But now, you know, the Mission Impossible franchise has become the sort of go-to spy franchise, so perhaps they're looking away at trying to sort of piggyback off the back of that and sort of go with a bit of style on that. But I think, you know, what I always wanted from Bond, but it was ruined by Skyfall, was that when it became a very personal story and he sort of goes back to his childhood home and you discover that, yes, James Bond's name is actually James Bond. I was always thinking that James Bond was a code name given to whatever agent was 007. Which is why you've got, you know, this long series of movies where, you know, George Lazenby goes, well, that didn't happen to the other fella. It's like this thing, and it's because for a super spy, always going into casinos and going, the name's Bond, James Bond, and people seem to know who he is. So it was that kind of idea that it was a name rather than a person you know, like this mystique, this sort of mysterious person, this mysterious spy. They don't know who it is, but it's James, but they know the name James. You know the name. That kind of thing, but you know, that's now been blown with the whole Skyfall sort of thing. So I guess we'll never see that. So it'd be interesting to know where the story will go next. I mean, I was sort of trying to come up with a story myself, and it's going to be interesting to see how Bond fits in the era that we live in now. Because one thing I think he will have to do is change potentially his ways with women, given the Me Too movement. I don't know if his romancing and Lothario type ways and discarding of women will play. I mean, I'm sure it would probably still play well with certain types of audiences, but other audiences might find it a bit sort of cavemanish and archaic and stuff like that. But
I mean, I suppose Bond's always faced that kind of issue, is like how it deals with women and his attitudes to it. And, you know, you think of something like Goldfinger, like probably one of people's most favourite and iconic James Bond movies. And, you know, he, in the book, he is essentially turning a lesbian pilot straight. And, you know, when you watch the film as well, he is forcing himself on her. You know, it's, we can all say, well, it was of the time and stuff, but the James Bond movies are incredibly problematic, and you know, it's always been about how as an audience we meet that when we watch it a few years after the fact, a few decades. You know, even something like Skyfall, which I rank as one of the best James Bond movies, you can't almost ignore that there's a scene where he literally walks into a shower on a woman that has been prostituted essentially from a young age, and basically just starts making out with her, and it's a consensual kiss, you know, romance, but he literally walks in naked on her into the shower, and there's no kind of build up to it apart from, you know, they have a talk in a bar, there's a bit of flirtation action, she thinks he's dead, and then he's there in the shower. And you know, I think with Bond, like for me, I've always, you know, I for me, it's never been a code name. It's always been, yeah, they're the same James Bond, but you know, like something like the Roger Moore ones, you know, he goes to the grave of the wife Tracy that dies in George Lazenby's movie, and you know, it's I've never bought into it. And I think Skyfall is potentially one of the best James Bond movies. You know, it could be the best on another given day. So I think Skyfall really worked for me with that personal aspect, that it really made it personal. It dealt with his family's death and life, and you know what it was, what it was like to be a young James Bond, and how he became the man we were. But Spectre ruined it by continuing to drag it out further. Like, oh, I had basically a stepbrother, and now he's Blofeld and things like that. It's like, sweet Jesus, what the hell are you doing? Like I remembered watching that movie, and I was so excited for that movie. I was so hyped. And I remember coming out of that movie in the ultimate denial. You know, even Star Wars prequel apologists would kind of blush at how I came out. I was like, yeah, it was really good, really good. And then I went to see it like a few days later, and I was like, oh, no. Like, I think there's elements that I think are great in the film. You know, I think the whole dining table scene with Spectre is awesome. You know, and then that's maybe mostly it for the film. There's some good bits here and there, but you know, it's a pretty terrible film. And you know, what made Skyfall unique, they took it far too far in Spectre, and you know, it was such a disappointment, absolutely disappointing.
Yeah, I think it was one of those films where, yeah, it could never really live up to that. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why Daniel Craig wants to come back, because, you know, after the high of Skyfall, you know, then, you know, it was palpable just how disappointed people were in it. And perhaps he wants, you know, one more crack at it to leave on a really good film. So perhaps that could be it. But again, a lot may come down to, you know, the villains of it. You know, when Spectre came out in 2015, you know, a lot has changed. You know, this was just before, you know, The Interview was meant to come out, but then, you know, the North Korean hacks and whatever. And you know, the choice of villain is not as clear cut, you know, because, you know, a lot of money comes from China these days. You know, you've got to have a Chinese market. So if you have a Chinese villain, then people might go, ooh, but then there's the whole Russia thing, which is still going on. You know, is that going to work? You know, I think they have to be slightly more, I think there's a lot more thought that has to go in rather than just being, oh, you know, just, you know, I'll just make it the Russians this time. It'll be fine. But if, you know, if it is Russians, it's going to be interesting to see. You know, if they did a proper, you know, this is set in the real world version where, you know, in post-Brexit Bond, what does he do? You know, he can't fly direct to Russia because, you know, he's not allowed to fly over EU airspace. So he has to take delayed Eurostars and get stopped at the borders and spends 2 hours in a passport queue. You know, that's not an exciting Bond film. So what are they going to do? I guess they'll just have to Halo jump him in, but then that's just copying Mission Impossible. That's, of course, if he doesn't spend the entire majority of the films stuck in a sexual harassment in the workplace lawsuit. Who knows?
I think, as you said, kind of Bond especially has always been reactionary, whereas it used to be, you know, the film that led the way, that we saw the Bourne impact on something like Casino Royale and kind of sort of the serialization that was kind of coming into films, you know, paying off in Casino Royale, you know, the influence of something like Christopher Nolan on The Dark Knight Rises, and then sort of expanding upon that into Spectre. And I'd like to see Bond going back to being the one that kind of, you know, leads the charge again. You know, Mission Impossible in terms of set pieces has been leading the way, and everyone else looks at that and goes, oh, right, I need to try and up that now. Even Fast and the Furious, it's things like that, of like car chases have been, you know, better than anything the Bond movies have done in years and years. I think even the last great car sequence really, you know, was in fact probably Die Another Day, which I think isn't as bad as people claim it is, but it's still pretty rubbish. But I think with I want to see Bond leading the way, or just, you know, not reacting to things, just playing to its strength. Like, you have Daniel Craig, who is a brilliant, brilliant actor. Play to his strengths, do something small and intimate and build around him. And I think someone like David Mackenzie, if he was interested, you know, Hell or High Water, you know, he's a Scottish director, we'll see him in Outlaw King later in this year. He could play to that kind of strengths, you know. So, you know, something like Denis Villeneuve, you know, I've just pronounced that name terribly wrong, he wouldn't play... We've seen him things like Enemy and Prisoners. He could do that as well. But whether with the way his career is going, whether he wants to pull back to something small again, you know, Jan Demenagi, 71 is a brilliant film. Absolutely. Like, I saw that in the cinema and it terrified me with the tension. You know, there's a scene in particular where they're banging bin lids and it's so tense. He could do a movie like that. So I think they really need to think, right, what is our strengths? You know, it doesn't need to be a 300, 400 million movie like Spectre was. Make a good movie with a Daniel Craig Bond, and if it's going to be his last one, just throw everything on the table in terms of making something tense and taut. That's what I want to see so badly.
So I'm looking through a list on IMDb of directors. I'm going to shout out a couple of names and see what you think. If you're looking for something tense and taut, Catherine Bigelow. Would you like to see a female... director take on Bond?
The best person for the job. Catherine Bigelow has been brilliant for, you know, Zero Dark Thirty is one of my favourite movies of the past decade, so completely on board with that.
Action and kinetic. George Miller. Would you like to see a Mad Max style?
I'd pay to... you know what, I would take it all back. I would see, like, a big action blockbuster done by Dan. Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of a Brit who's done a couple of the best films last year, what about Alex Garland taking on Bond? Do you think he would?
Absolutely, yeah.
I know he had some studio issues over the distribution of Annihilation, but I think he could do something really quite interesting. And left field choice, Taika Waititi.
I'd pay to see him do anything. Whatever he wants to do. Does he want to make Bond a comedy? Yeah. Does he want to make it a buddy movie? Yeah. Whatever he wants to do, I would pay to see him. You know, I worship as like hashtag film Twitter at his altar.
Okay, so do you have any other sort of thoughts about what you'd like to see in a Bond film, or who you'd like to see?
I'm just, you know what, I must say, one thing that I've become so sick of is the whole Idris Elba conversation that has dragged on for years.
We haven't even talked about who we want to play James Bond after Daniel Craig leaves.
Yeah. Like, it's been one of those ones that's gone on for years, even when Daniel Craig is in the midst of making a movie, like, hey, Idris Elba, do you want to be Bond? And it's almost become shorthand for, if you want that Idris Elba to be in Bond, you know, it's such an easy thing to say. Whereas if you don't want him to be Bond, I personally don't want him to be Bond. It has nothing to do with his skin tone. It has to do with the fact that he is nearly 50, and I can't picture him in the role. And it's nothing to do with his skin tone or anything like that. I just don't personally think he is the right fit for something like James Bond. And I'm an Idris Elba fan. I've got a picture taken with him. But it has just become tedious that Idris Elba has become shorthand for, you know, race politics, gender politics, all these different things with how people want to discuss James Bond. You know, if you don't want a black James Bond, you know, that you're this or that. I have no problem with a black James Bond, But he is not the person I would pick to be the Black James Bond at this moment in time, because by the time Daniel Craig potentially finishes the movie, this guy's going to be in his early 50s. He will be the oldest James Bond ever. Not for me.
Yeah, no, I think I think he'd be too old to take. I think if they're looking to sort of start up a new sort of era of the franchise, they have to go with someone older. You know, no disrespect to Idris Elba, but yes, there's only... Actually, there's only really Tom Cruise who can handle an action franchise and do his own stunts at that age. I think Tom definitely proved it with Mission Impossible Fallout. But I know there's a lot of talk about Henry Cavill at the moment. I think, yeah, he'd do a perfectly acceptable job. He might be, I think, maybe too obvious a choice and yes, maybe too similar. So maybe something a bit left field again. You know, I know they talked about, was it Gillian Anderson for Jane Bond, you know, a female version of it, but you know,
yeah,
oh, I mean, God, the internet would just come self-combust if that happened. I mean, good God,
imagine the Daily Mail.
Oh, jeez. I mean, they were bad enough when Daniel Craig had blonde hair. I mean, they eventually came round to it, but yeah, no, I don't know. But I guess, you know, I think we've still got a few months of every website and every newspaper being able to get a good dozen think pieces on who the next James Bond is, who's going to direct Bond, and what should happen to Bond. But I mean, we've got a good half hour of chat out of it at least anyway, but it'd be interesting to hear.
All I will add one last thing. This shows how the newspapers know nothing about James Bond. They come out after the fact going, Idris Elba could be Bond, this person could be Bond, you know, this is the movie, it's going to be about this, it's going to be about a Russian, it's going to be about this. Not one single paper got ahead of this story about Danny Boyle leaving the film. Not one. So next time someone posts, hey, oh my God, like, look at this Daily Mail headline about James Bond, whether it's a positive, negative, and the Daily Mail has a decent track record, to be fair, about James Bond, and then milking think pieces for months on this, even though it's such a nonsense story. And like, I'm just sick of that cycle, and I'm so glad that this story got out ahead of all of the usual suspects.
Yeah, no, I think it's one that hopefully they can cast someone soon as director, not as James Bond, because that's a whole other can of worms. And hopefully they can get the franchise back on track. I mean, it's, you know, he's one of, you know, the UK's greatest cinematic creations. And yeah, I think we do still need Bond. It'd be interesting, you know, there's still a need for that spy. It depends. Hopefully they find the right story for him as well. But it'd be interesting to hear what listeners have to say and who they'd like to direct the next Bond film. And so if you want to let us know your thoughts, you can get us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party, and let us know who you want to see, or if people wanted to reach out and talk about Bond with you on online, where can they get you?
Yeah, you can find me at Lee_Nostromo. I look forward to having a Bond conversation with anyone any day of the week. It's, you know, it's, I think this is actually the first time in like 30 episodes that we've really had a proper Bond conversation. Like, we miss Spectre for some reason, and it's just never got round to it, and I'm so glad that I can finally have this conversation. Hopefully the next one will be about an actual James Bond movie.
Yeah, we might have to wait a couple of years before it's finally on screens, but yeah, I look forward to that. But if you want to talk with me on Twitter, you can find me at champcelluloid, or you can read my reviews on championshipcelluloid.blogspot.com. Until next week, we'll have to leave you to die another day, I guess. So we'll catch you next time. Cheers now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.